Well, you kind of wish. What's that?
All right.
Yeah. Sometimes I know that we kind of wish we could get a forecast like that. 63. Do you know what's significant about the number 63?
Year of my birth.
Okay, it's the year of Najla's birth. I'm surprised you're willing to admit those kinds of things, but that's cool. Good for you. 63. No guesses. I can see why there would be no guesses. There's no reason why you would be thinking along the lines that I'm thinking. But 63 is the number of predictions of the end of the world there have been since the year that I was born. That's how many. I'm 55 years old. That's averaging over one a year of predictions for the end of the world or the rapture to come. It was going to happen before that day. That's one of the main reasons, with the sheer number of predictions that we get floating around out there. That's one of the reasons that people will oftentimes roll their eyes if somebody starts talking about, you know, the world coming to an end or the end of the age. But on the other hand, we're always going to have this sense of intrigue associated with that. There's a sensationalism that's inherent in predictions of the end of the world. It's exciting stuff, and people really get into it. They have traditionally in the church, all through the church's history. It's titillating. It incites fear or excitement. And there can be no doubt that there has been an ongoing captivation with the end of the world predictions and the church. For some, it actually became kind of a cottage industry, especially in different sectors of the church. There was a man, I won't mention his name, but there was a man who made four different predictions about when the rapture was going to occur at different times, and he sold books at each time. You would think after the first one, he fooled me once, but either way, he sold a lot of books no matter what. When it comes to the predictions about the end, we seem to fall into two categories as I've interacted with people. We either are people who just kind of dismiss the thing altogether, or we are people who devour it all obsessively. And I would contest that both of those responses are incorrect. The answer that we're looking for, the response that we need, is somewhere in the middle of all of this. As much as it may make modernists uncomfortable, Jesus did function as a prophet who foretold the end of the world. And I know that makes some people uncomfortable, but all three synoptic gospels have a version of the text that we're going to read today as we come back into our study of Matthew. And if you've got a Bible or a Bible app, a way of following along, head over to Matthew chapter 24, please. The next two chapters in Matthew are going to deal with future predictions, or at least with a theme about the end of the age that Jesus makes to his disciples, predictions that he makes to his disciples. Many times, Bible teachers look at what Jesus said here, and they'll see what he describes here, and then they'll start combing through current events to try to match up with his statements, and then begin to read them as signs of the approaching end, you know, with the intent of stirring up a level of anticipation and enthusiasm for Christ's return. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's certainly nothing wrong with wanting to have a passion about Jesus' returning and setting all things right. But the methodology that gets employed so often isn't necessarily consistent with what Jesus was saying himself in the section that we're going to look at. It's not necessarily consistent with the way Jesus approached this whole subject matter. While we tend to look at the Bible sometimes as a handbook about how things are going to wrap up here on earth, if you actually average it out of 66 books, there's a minority of space. There's a smaller section of space devoted to the concepts of the end of history than there is on other issues in there. In Matthew's gospel, out of 28 chapters, we've got two. And really, you could almost say one and a half of these chapters that touch on the end of the age as a specific topic. And even there, we've got to carefully understand what it is that Jesus is talking about. If we look at this section objectively, we're going to notice that Jesus' emphasis is different from what we assume oftentimes. The overarching idea is that the world as it's known, both for Israel and for people at large, will end one day. But the emphasis is on how we should live in light of that reality. how we should be living, how we should be responding, what our responsibilities are as believers in this process. Jesus does call us to live like the world's ending, but that doesn't necessarily mean what we think it means sometimes. There's a more important theme in the long run of how it is that we live. And I mean, think about it. If you knew that the world was going to end tomorrow, what would change in your priority? What would you do? What would be the first thing you'd think you'd want to do if the world was going to end tomorrow? Anybody? Wait, I heard go home, but I also heard what?
Leave here.
Go to the beach. Okay. Get with the grandkids, spend time with people that you love. And so, but then the question that automatically gets asked after that is, why are we waiting till the end of the world to attend to some of these things? Because here's the thing, we get really caught up in trying to discern when these things are going to happen, because there is a certain sensationalism associated with that. But Jesus is going to remind us that the world's ending doesn't affect our job description at all. If the world ends 1,000 years from now or ends in the next few minutes, we still have the exact same commission. That never changes for us as his followers. So as Jesus lays some prophetic insight on us this morning, let's also pay attention to his instructions on how it is that we live our lives in light of a fading world, of an ending world. So, okay, if you're there in Matthew 24, we're going to begin with verse 1. This is still the final week. Remember that Jesus is, before he's facing the cross, he's there in Jerusalem for the Passover celebration, and he's had these confrontations with the religious leaders and all of these things, and all of that finally came to its conclusion. It says in verse 1, Jesus left the temple where all these things were happening and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see these? You see all these. Do you not? Truly, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" Okay, here we've got our header for this whole section, and so we need to unpack these verses just a little bit to get our bearings, to understand what it is exactly that we're talking about here. Jesus and his followers are leaving the temple area. Likely they're heading back to Bethany where they've been staying, and his disciples are looking at the amazing craftsmanship that went into making Herod's temple. It was a remarkable building as far as we understand. The construction project actually was still going on in Jesus' day. So there would have been, you know, signs of construction all around that. But of course, that would have lent its impact on the disciples. They would have been looking at this. Isn't it incredible what they're able to do? Interestingly enough, the temple, Herod's temple, did not get completed until 64 AD. Now, Jesus responds to their wonder and their awe about the temple. He responds with an apocalyptic description of the temple's destruction. And a mere 6 years after the temple was completed, to crush a Jewish uprising, General Titus went in and laid siege to Jerusalem and finally sacked the city and destroyed the temple utterly. Now, Jesus employs hyperbole. There are still some stones left on top of each other. But the idea behind it, it's prophetic hyperbole, the idea was it was going to be utterly destroyed. And this did happen in 70 A.D., And then in our narrative, as Jesus is hanging out with his disciples on the Mount of Olives, they ask him this intriguing question. They say, "When will these things be?" And obviously, they're talking about what he just has been referencing, the forecast of the temple's destruction. But then they add a second question on, "What will be the sign of your coming and the close of the age?" Which is a much larger question than the first part of that. To read the second question in English actually seems a little bit odd. When you just read it there, you know, what will be the sign of your coming? He's right there in front of them, you know, and they certainly aren't living within anticipation that he's leaving anywhere. So what in the world are they talking about? It's easy for us to look at that and just read into it our own theology of eschatology, you know, expecting the return of Jesus. They didn't have that in view when they say, "What's the sign of your coming?" The word that's used there when they say, "What's the sign of your coming?" is the Greek word parousia. And it's the first occurrence of this word in the Gospels. And it's a word that within the Greco-Roman culture meant the arrival Or the presence. It's literally the presence, but it means the arrival of a king. If Caesar was to arrive, or Caesar takes the throne, that is the coming of Caesar at that point. That's the parousia of Caesar. So that's what they're talking about. They're not anticipating him leaving. They're asking, when are you going to be revealed as the king that you are, as the messianic king? So when we look at this, this is what we're talking about. This is what this section is dealing with here. It's two different things. It's the end of the temple age. That's the first thing that Jesus was talking about, the destruction of the temple. And then it's also the end of the fallen age, or the eradication of the world's broken system when Jesus is revealed as king. Those are the two things in view in this section. Now, for the disciples, I don't believe they saw this or understood this as two different questions. They had no expectation of some sort of delay or gap between, you know, the end of the temple and Jesus being, you know, if the temple's gone, then certainly the end of the age is upon us and Jesus is now revealed as king. But history has borne out that there is indeed a sizable gap between the end of the temple age, which happened in 70 AD, and the visible arrival or presence of Jesus as king, Christ as king. So it's important for us, I hope it's not getting too technical for everybody, but it's important for us to keep the two subjects in view as we look at what Jesus says in this discourse and consider how some of what he's saying fits with the past and some of this fits with a future yet to come. But most of all, we're going to see how it is that we're supposed to respond in light of these events. So let's pick back up in our narrative here, starting in verse 4. And Jesus answered, they were saying, when's the signs of these things? He says, Jesus answered, see that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and they'll lead many astray. And you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. See to it that you're not alarmed, for this must take place. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Okay. Jesus doesn't address the question of when. You notice that, right? He just kind of dismisses that altogether. Instead, he starts talking about the suffering that was going to be characterizing this broken world. Now, there's a tendency with modern teachers, and I've noticed it over the years, I certainly grew up with this sort of thing, where modern teachers of prophecy will look at this list that Jesus gives and begin comparing it to contemporary events. Oh, look at this war that's happening. This is a sign. There's a war in the Middle East. This is a sign. Or one of the things that was the most intriguing to me is one guy went on a whole thing about, you know, we have more earthquakes now in the last 100 years than we ever had in history. The problem with that is we didn't really start tracking earthquakes for the last 100 years, and technology's gotten better, which means that we're obviously going to be recognized. So I don't know. Teachers will point to famines and wars and new diseases and hurricanes as evidence of the looming end, and it does usually stir a lot of fervor. But I will mention that fervor is not a sustainable fervor, and that needs to be something that registers in our thinking as we're trying to discern how it is that we understand these passages. The thing that we really have to remember here is that Jesus clearly states that what he's describing are not the signs of the end. He specifically, explicitly says, these are not signs of the end. So, you know, just get that clear. These are just the beginnings of birth pangs. Now, the New Testament says over and over, and we won't take the time to go through this, but makes the claim over and over that from the time of Jesus' resurrection and ascension, we are living in the last days. His resurrection and ascension marks the beginning of the last days. The clock begins ticking from that point until now. And it's a slow clock, to be sure, but it's ticking. People will ask me, you know, when do you think the end times will happen? And I'll say, well, today and tomorrow and the next day after that and on until it finally ends. Because this is the reality that the Bible expresses to us, time on a linear plane. That from the moment Jesus ascended into heaven and the church was birthed into this earth, we are in the last days. We are ticking towards some end somewhere. What Jesus is describing is the time that we live in. And we have been living in this time for 2,000 years. Times of confusion and turmoil and war and disease and natural disasters. See, the problem with just looking at contemporary events and saying, well, there you go, this is it, this is the sure sign, this has been going on a long time. We can go back into medieval history and see a lot of people making predictions about the things that they saw then. My dad was a preacher during World War II. He was really old, but he was a preacher during World War II. And he used to talk to me about how during World War II, the church, the evangelical church, was absolutely convinced this was the end of the age. Everything was right there. You got wars, global wars, you got disease, you got all this stuff happening. And of course, you know, the war came to its conclusion, and we continue on going. Jesus wasn't trying to give us markers for what we're going to see. He's trying to explain to us what the world's going to be like as the church is living in it. See, the disciples had assumed that Jesus as Messiah was going to launch the golden age of Israel and then reestablish the earth. Now that Jesus is here and Messiah is here, they were expecting everything's going to be getting better. And Jesus is dissuading them of that idea. He's telling them the advance of God's kingdom is going to happen while this broken world still convulses. It's God's kingdom is going to be advancing through this place even while you see all this suffering, even while you see all these things going crazy. But what Jesus emphasizes in this section is our response to that. And that ultimately is the most important thing, the thing that we sometimes don't pay attention to. Because as we live our lives in light of the end of history, we need to stay focused on our mission. And that's what Jesus says right off the bat. And when they say, when's this going to happen? He says, see to it that you don't get led astray. And Jesus points to false teachers and fake messiahs, people who would come and try to alter the course that Jesus set us on. And he tells us, tune that noise out. Don't listen to that. People will come along claiming to be someone special, announcing a new and better way, announcing that they've got the prophecy that's going to make the whole thing, you know, happen or what have you. And Jesus says, look, just stay the course. Stay with the simple gospel. Now, that certainly happened throughout history, what he's described there. It happened in the immediate sense for them, for the disciples, in the immediate time frame after Jesus' ascension. But it's happened periodically. We can go all the way through. It still happens to this day, right? I mean, we're aware of that, that there are still people who jump up and claim to be the somebody special. And it's just, you know, it's not just religious teaching either that can veer us off course. It can be cultural priorities that attempt to be loud enough to eclipse the mission that Jesus set us on, the mission to reconcile humanity to its creator. That is our mission. Always boil it down in your mind. This is what we're here to do. We're here on the mission to reconcile a fallen and broken humanity with its loving creator. And he points to all the ways in which this world suffers through wars and natural disasters. And those things are terrible and they're upsetting. But Jesus tells us not to be frightened by how bad the world looks. Don't be alarmed, he says. Be alert, be aware, but not alarmed. Be conscious of what you hear and see, but don't be cowering in a bunker somewhere waiting for the end to come. Where false teaching and false ideologies pose the danger of pushing us off course by inserting new values and new priorities that are different from the gospel, the other troubles that he describes here pose the danger of getting us fearfully obsessed with trying to stay safe, which will also cause us to veer off of the course that Jesus set us on by engendering fear. And fear is a powerful motivator. It really is, but it is a twisted one. We never, ever, as followers of Jesus, want to allow fear to become our motive for how it is that we attend to the mission at hand. Fear will prompt us to look for enemies and build walls between ourselves and others, and instead of extending the grace of God into the midst of this mess like Jesus did. What Jesus is trying to explain to his disciples and to us is that we have to expect there to be a lot of noise, a lot of voices calling for our attention, a lot of voices trying to define us and define what our priorities should be. We need to tune that out and stay the course. We have to expect that the world is always going to be going stupid and convulsing and reeling. It is not a safe place. But it's the place we've been called to. It's the place where our mission takes place. And the hard reality is, this broken world will not make a safe space for God's kingdom. And Jesus expounds on that, continuing on into verse 9. He says, then they'll deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. Now, in the immediate context, when Jesus spoke this, what he says here was fulfilled by the Jewish leaders of that time. Coupled with his forecast that he made back in chapter 23, Jesus is talking about the intense persecution that the early church faced from the religious leaders of Israel, from the temple leadership. And it was intense, and the book of Acts expounds on that for us. But we know that it actually expanded from there. It moved from just being a localized temple threat to include the ferocious ways in which the Roman Empire persecuted Christians. And we know that that sort of persecution against people who profess a faith in Jesus Christ continues on to this day in many places in the world. Many places are closed nations. And terrible persecution still erupts against the gospel and against the people who are representative of the gospel to this day. Here in the United States, we don't face the intensity of it. But if we've been paying attention at all, there's a growing hostility towards Christians or Christianity. Really, I would actually say people of any faith, there's a growing hostility there towards anyone who's expressing a faith or religion. But it seems, and probably because I'm from that perspective, it seems like it's especially towards Christianity. But Jesus is warning us that the world's broken system, the way the world functions and operates, will not make a place for us. It's going to make it hard on those who call Jesus king. They're going to persecute and pressure and marginalize in an effort to get us to give up this crazy notion of a king who loves us, of a prince of peace. And when the pressure gets turned up, he says the temptation is and will be to just throw in the towel. You know, this isn't even worth it. This is too much work. I'm just going to give up this whole love Christ, love others, even love my enemies kind of thing. This is way too hard. The world is too difficult and making it too difficult. And teachers, he says, and prophets will come along to suggest a different way. Well, you don't have to do this. We need a more violent Christianity or something. Let's get in there and give it back to them or something. And Jesus makes it clear the world doesn't get better on its own. Don't expect that they're going to make a place for us somewhere along the line. He says lawlessness will increase. And he doesn't mean by that, you know, we're going to be able to look at our specific culture and recognize moral failures as increasing. But what he's saying in that is that this place is not going to get better on its own. We can't just, you know, it doesn't get easier with age or something. It grows worse. We could say, when we talk about lawlessness, he means wickedness, immorality, that sort of thing. Immoral, the immoral presence within the culture, within the government, or whatever. It's never just going to fade away. It always increases in any given society, at any given time in history during this last 2,000 years that we've been in what's designated as the last days. And Jesus correlates that increased wickedness, and I find this fascinating. He correlates the increased wickedness with the temptation to grow cold in love. How interesting that that's what he connects the whole thing to. The love for God that motivates our love for our fellow person. Jesus is warning us the world is full of pressures. There's going to be a lot of pressure here. Pressures from society, pressures from culture, pressure from religion, pressure from governments to give up this foolish love business. Forget about all of that stuff. And still, though, remember, the major theme of this section, we keep that in mind, is the temporary nature of this world's systems. Those things are passing away. And if we're going to live our lives in light of how fading and fleeting these pressures from this fallen world are, then we need to remember our calling is to endure in our love for God and for humanity. That's what we want to hold fast to, regardless of what kind of pressure gets put on us, regardless of how unjust it may feel at the moment. We're called to continue on loving God, loving others. In Revelation 2, Jesus speaks a message to the various local churches there in that region. And in some ways, what he says there represent things that go on with all churches all the time. And when he spoke to the church in Ephesus, he commended them for all sorts of things, holding on to the faith that they had in the face of hardships. But then he warned them that they were abandoning their first love. The hardships that they were facing, the pressures that were there, were tempting them to abandon this first love, the love that they had for God, the love that they had for humanity as a result of that love. And he called them, repent, turn around from that. Don't let this happen in your life. Don't slip away, slide away from that love. Love is the motivation for true righteousness. We'll never know real righteousness apart from it. Love for God, love for people, as we saw back in chapter 22. Those are the values on which the entire Old Testament law hinged on. Jesus laid it all out there. Love is the premise for the gospel, that God so loved the world that he gave his son for us. Love is the identifying characteristic of God's kingdom in this world. Love is how the world's going to recognize us as followers of Jesus, according to John 13. Groups of people have always identified themselves all through history around certain things, different things. So they've identified themselves by skin color or uniform or by shared interest or political alliance or shared language. They're identified by foods that they'll eat or they won't eat, or by tattoos or by baldness or rituals or all kinds of different things. But the church is unique because for the first time that we know of in history, Jesus calls a group together whose identifying factor is simply love. That's profound. That's huge in terms of its ramifications. Skin color doesn't matter. Endemic culture doesn't matter. There are no rules or requirements about diet or uniforms or ink or no ink or rituals or none. As followers of Jesus, our identifying characteristic is love. Our love for one another expressed in our love for God. And when this passing world is pressing in, we have to be careful not to abandon this high ethic, this high calling of love, because that's the thing, even based on what Jesus is saying here, that's the thing that the world wants to pressure out of us, wants to squeeze out of us, wants to press us to the wall to remove from us, is our love. We got to see to it. We hold on to that, endure in that love. Well, finishing up, we'll read verse 14. Jesus gives one more description of this present world with an implied instruction for us. Verse 14, he says, "And this gospel of the kingdom, of God's kingdom, will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." All circumstances that Jesus described, this is where we're stopping today, but all circumstances that Jesus described before this verse were completely out of our control. We're not things that we can control in terms of the events that are taking place. This is the only one that's actually given directly into our hands. We are the ones who make the decision to share the good news of God's loving authority, God's kingdom, or not. That's been handed over to us. This is something that we can make the determination on. If we're going to live in light of an ending world, we realize then that we need to continue to advance the gospel in our world. Continue on in this mission. I'm someone who believes there are two sides to what Jesus means by the gospel is preached to all nations and then the end comes. I think that he's referring to the gospel moving beyond Israel and to the Gentiles, and then the end of the temple age occurs, which is pretty much the way that happened throughout history. But I also believe there are layers to prophetic fulfillment in this, and this is also something that applies to subsequent generations, that our mission is to keep expanding the good news right up until the end of history. We keep doing this until the story comes to its close. And I don't know that this is something to apply literally, as in as soon as every nationality has a chance to hear the gospel, then boom, show's over, or, you know, the last tract gets handed out and the curtain closes. I believe it's just revealing the nature of our mission to keep on sharing this good news, to keep on advancing the news of God's love in this world, to go to places and people who still need to hear it and to support those who go. Just like we got a trip coming up to Haiti in the next few weeks. So we want to support that. We got people who are going in that. That's all part of this mission that we're on. To let the light of God's love shine everywhere, not just in Haiti or South Sudan, but next door, in our own neighborhoods, to let the light of God's love shine at work or within our family or here as we gather together. This is still part of it all. And, you know, we can look at that and we use euphemisms like that. And I know that a person could sit and say, well, but what does that look like, Rob? We talk about shining a light, et cetera. What does that look like? How do I do that? I can actually distill this very easily for one main thing. It means just be a decent person in the world where you've been placed. A person who cares about other people, who's willing to serve others and not always seeking our own self-interest and definitely not seeking the harm of any other human being. And then be that person and be that person who's then not afraid to describe these characteristics as an imitation of Jesus. In other words, the reason that I want to be a decent person in this world is because I'm a follower of Jesus, and this is what his kingdom is all about. This is what God looks like. Listen, sharing the good news, you know, when we talk about that, that can be a very awkward kind of thing. And as I said before, there are some strong, even, you know, negative and hostile opinions towards Christianity. Some of that's our own fault in some of the ways that we behaved, but, you know, so knowing that there's sometimes some hostility there, it's, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, make sure you go into a crowded room of strangers saying, I'd like to talk to you about Jesus or something like that. That's not necessarily going to be helpful. It's very awkward to do. We don't have to make it extra awkward by doing things that aren't natural or normal by most standards. You don't have to march over to the neighbor's door, pound on it, and interrogate him. If you die today, do you know where you're going to go into eternity? I mean, it's probably a good way to get shot nowadays. But we can be kind to our neighbor, right? We can pay attention. If the yard needs mowing, find out if, are you sick? Can I do something here? We can carry groceries for someone or just care about the people around us. And if someone wants to return a compliment for that kind of behavior, we can be brave enough to just say, well, you know what? I'm a follower of Jesus. I'm just doing what I think he would be doing here. It's as simple as that. And I'm not trying to give you a script, you know, okay, Rob says to say, you know, I'm not trying to give a primer for witnessing or anything like that, but sharing the good news is as simple as living out a love for our fellow human being and ascribing that action to Jesus. It doesn't get much more simple than that. It's about praying for God to provide the encounter and for the Holy Spirit to provide the right words. Usually that's just going to be our own story. That's what's best. And then entrusting the results of that to Jesus. I think part of the trouble that we get into with this is that within the evangelical culture, we've kind of developed a salesperson mentality. You know, like we've got to get somebody to the bottom line. How many decisions did we get here? We use that terminology. We had 25 decisions for the Lord. Well, that's good. I'm glad about that. But I don't know that that's what our calling is. We're not trying to put a notch on our Bible for every soul we got saved. We're here to represent the reality of God's love. Present that to the world and then entrust that to Jesus. I can't save anybody. I can genuinely say you can't either. We're all in the same boat. We've got to trust that Jesus is going to take care of the results. But it's still our mission. Just because Jesus is going to take care of the results, it's still our mission to advance the reality of God's goodness in this world and ascribe that goodness to Jesus. To let the world know that there is a king who loves them. That there's a prince of peace who wants to bring that peace to them. I know, it's easy to say. We're here in a very friendly environment. It's very easy to say it's a challenge to live out, but it is our challenge. We can't just dismiss it because it's difficult sometimes or not easy. It's our challenge. It's what we're called to. The thing is, in light of what we're talking about today, our job description, this is what I want to get at, our job description never changes. in all of this. This is exactly what the church has been called to through all of these things. We're called to stay the course of loving God and loving others, to share the good news of God's love to the world around us, regardless of when history comes to its close. If someone says, you know, well, the Bible codes predict the end is going to be tomorrow, or solar eclipse is going to end it in August, or calculated the years of Jubilee that we've missed, and the catastrophic events are in store for July, we can just shrug and say, okay, what's that got to do with me? Because I'm on a mission from God. I'm here doing what it is that I've been called to do, to love God and love people and share the good news of his grace. And if the world ends 5 minutes from now, my mission doesn't change. I'm the same person that I've always been meant to be. So let's not get caught up in sensational hype. We're going to be dealing with some things that could lend itself to that, but let's not get caught up in that. Let's be aware, but not alarmed. Let's not live in fear, but let's live out of love for God and see how that can affect the world around us. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please?